It sure is, with our special guest this hour, David Montgomery and Anne Bickley, as we talk about their work, the hidden half of nature. We're talking about microbes. That's right. Fascinating, too, isn't it? Well, we're going to come back, too. We'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast with our two guests, David Montgomery and Bickley, the hidden half of nature. We'll get to your calls, too, this hour as we talk about microbes. I guess you would say, David, that microbes are critical for our survival.
Yeah, you know, we've been had our eyes open to that in the last few decades as to just how true that is and the ways in which that's true, both from facilitating the growth of healthy crops and also in terms of maintaining our own health in the face of the modern maladies that so affect so many people, a lot of the chronic diseases. We used to die from infectious diseases and advances, you know, with antibiotics and sanitation, clean water systems, has really reduced the infectious diseases. But in terms of managing those suite of chronic diseases that now plague so many of us in the developed world, it turns out that the microbial life, our microbiome, and its disruption through both overuse of antibiotics and changes in our diet have played a big role in what keeps us healthy now. So you look at the big picture, and yeah, we've been learning that microbial life is one of our best allies. They're some of our worst enemies, but also some of our best allies. As Anne mentioned earlier, there's this great duality in our relationship with them, and we've tended to look at them through one aspect of that and think of them as bad. We're starting to learn how to cultivate the good guys.
Well, you sure are. And Anne, as you look at this work that you've been doing, where does it go next? I mean, what's the next evolution for this?
Wow. I think the next evolution for all of this is that we know now enough about the microbiome that what we really ought to be starting to do, especially with you know, much younger people and certainly, you know, from birth onward, we should be looking at ways of better protecting each and every person's microbiome. But we also know, like, for example, your friend with the knee operation, and also at some point in our lives, nearly everybody gets some kind of an infection that requires antibiotics. But after those antibiotics, we should be prescribing probiotics. And so that's where restoring the microbiome, I think, should be a part of the future of medicine. And then, of course, while you're protecting it, and if there's a need for restoration, either case, the microbiome has got to be cultivated. I mean, every farmer and gardener out there knows, you know, if you want to take care of plants, you want to be able to harvest something, whether it's food or beauty or shade or what have you, you've got to cultivate those plants. And the same thing goes with our microbiome, cultivating it.
And let's talk a little bit about probiotics for a moment, because we hear so much about it. I mentioned it a little bit last hour as well. Probiotics, what's the definition of a probiotic?
The definition is actually pretty simple. It basically says it's the actual organism, so typically most probiotics are bacteria, and when we ingest them, they confer health benefits. That's the simple definition of a probiotic.
Okay, and let's get to some of these calls in a second here. Those of you who are into science, this is your night right here on Coast to Coast as we talk about this. People, I know most people would take this for granted. They probably don't know about microbes. They think bacteria is bad, and schools don't teach this, and I'm talking about high schools as well. Would you agree, David?
Oh, yeah. You know, the kind of stuff that we were researching and writing about in this book is stuff that we didn't learn in college when we were trained in biology and geology. There's a lot that we've been learning in the last few decades that have changed our basic view of microbial life. And that's not to say that we should embrace the bad microbes or the pathogens, but it's that we've been treating them all with painting them all with the same broad brush. And so there really is a dawning new awareness of how we should be looking at microbial life what that means for some of our basic practices in the two fields of applied science that we really depend on, agriculture and medicine.
Now, Is there a dedicated science to this?
Yeah, there's many labs dedicated to studying the microbiome and the human microbiome and the plant microbiome. It's a very rich and exciting area of science. Neither Ann nor I are microbiome scientists. We're people who've sort of looked into this field and realized that, oh my, these people are really on to amazing discoveries and changing our view of nature. But there's a lot of activity that's actually really going on, and it's fundamentally interdisciplinary because some of the techniques and methods that you need to study microbial life are sort of biogeochemistry. You need genetics. There's new technologies that have opened our ability to actually look at the way the communities of invisible organisms, many of which look fairly similar, interact with one another, and their language and the way they interact with each other is dominantly through chemistry. So it's really an area that involves people that are chemists, that are geneticists, that are microbiologists, and then when you bring it into the field of agriculture or medicine, you're bringing in doctors and farmers and agronomists. It's a really exciting area of interdisciplinary science.
Okay, let's take some calls. Let's go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Bill.
Yes, hi, George. Hi. Hi, doctors. Hi. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I know space science. The reason I say that is because that directly leads to my quick comment leading into my question that involves the International Space Station specifically, particularly one mission that I'm sure I know you know about, and that is the one-year mission that just ended last month, March, by astronaut Scott Kelly, who, as you well know, has a twin brother, former astronaut Mark Kelly, so their genetic material are the same, or virtually the same, being identical twins, and NASA has engaged in for the past year and will be continuing to engage in when they get more samples, biological samples back, I think early next month from the SpaceX spacecraft. Scott Kelly's biological material samples, stool samples and other samples, blood, et cetera, from Scott Kelly from being in the ISS, International Space Station, for a whole year. At the same time, they got the same kind of sample, same studies from his brother Mark Kelly on planet Earth. So what I want to ask you specifically regarding that one-year microbiome study, and it's a biological study in total, part of it or major part of it, it involves microbiome. What insights as well as benefits could that study leave for humanity, us people on planet Earth?
Boy, well, you know, what an exciting opportunity to do a study like that, having somebody in space for a year and having an identical twin on Earth. I mean, it's really unique and bound to be incredible science. One of the things that is really apparent in a lot of microbiome research is just how unique the microbiomes of individual people are. And so in their case, you've got the identical genetic material with completely different environmental contexts and with different foods that they will have eaten for the year. It'll be really interesting to see what actually comes out of that, and I'd be hesitant to predict what will be learned from it, but what we have seen through a lot of research in the space program in the past are all kinds of unanticipated developments that follow on from it, and I'm going to be really excited to see what they get out of this one.
Okay, Bill, thank you. Appreciate it. That's a good question, by the way. Can these microbes be used in warfare? I hate to even ask you that, but can they be used to create something bad?
Boy, well, you know, the ex-Soviet Union and the U.S. both had germ warfare labs. I can't tell you the state of them because I'm not aware of that. I don't think Ann is either. But you can look at what the influenza virus of, 1919, if I recall correctly, did and killed so many people. You can look at, the worries about outbreaks of emerging diseases coming out of some of the tropical forests as they're being cleared, things like Ebola. The potential for microbial life to do great harm to humanity is huge, and they don't even want to think about what could be done with that in the wrong hands with the wrong ideas behind it. One of the things that microbes do very effectively is swap genetic material. So one of the real problems with thinking about manipulating the genome of microbes is that they won't keep it to themselves.
Okay, so a guy's at a restaurant, and part of his steak falls off on the floor, and he puts it back on his plate. Now, people would say, oh, my God, what are you doing that? All those germs. Is it really going to make a difference, David?
You know, I think probably not, no.
I don't think it is either.
A lot of the same microbes are on the table and in the air. You know, and actually, if you look at the benefits from getting microbes into your mouth as a young child, a lot of where we get our own microbiome from, well, part of it comes from our mother, but part of it comes from our environment early on in life. And there's real reasons to think that people who are not exposed to enough microbial life very early in their life have compromised immune systems, that it doesn't help with the development of their immune system, that it gets trained wrong. So one, you know, we've all seen kids, they're always putting stuff in their mouth, right, in the first couple of years of life. It's not necessarily all bad.
No, not necessarily at all. It's just remarkable the way this works. Why does bleach kill bacteria?
I'm not entirely sure, but most bacteria are really very sensitive to strong acids. And so it's a very powerful chemical immersion that I think bursts their cell walls.
Here's another strange one. So if you look at a bacterium under a microscope, it's moving around, it's wiggling. If it's dead, is it just there? What happens to it?
Yeah, a dead microbe is essentially a little nutrient packet. And Ann just reminded me that bleach is basic, so you can sort of like reverse that last answer that I gave you. But a dead microbe is like a little nutritional package. It's dead, and it will be reprocessed back into nutrients that can affect other life forms. It'll be eaten by other life forms.
Or does it decay?
Well, yeah, other microbes could help decay it, but it's already pretty small. Often what would happen, I think, would be that other organisms could consume it and then excrete it and thereby recycle it.
Now, Ann, let me ask you a question about health. If you take care of yourself with the proper probiotics, will you generally feel better?
Wow. I mean, I would think so. I think most people who are walking around who have, a pretty decent microbiome, whether they, whether that's through taking probiotics or whether that's through diet or other things, yeah, I think you're going to be feeling pretty well. I think people who have a messed up microbiome, you can talk to them and you'll find. We were, in fact, just at a conference last weekend, and someone was talking with us, and she's having a lot of brain fog and cognitive issues, and she's also having a lot of gut issues. And so there's evidence that when the gut is troubled, the mind is troubled.
Let's go to the phones now. Cliff is in Bristol, Tennessee. Welcome to the program, Cliff. You're on the air with us.
Hey, George. Love your show.
Thank you, Cliff.
Very informative. I was just going to ask you, down here in Tennessee, we have it seems like the past few years we've had a lack of monarch butterflies, box turtles, honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's, is that chemical or bacterial or, and second, first of all, bleach is sodium hypochlorite. That's a base, not an acid. And I'll take my answer off here.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
So that was your reversal there, David. But
yep. No, thank you for clarifying that, Cliff. That's why I like collaborating with other scientists like my wife to keep me on the straight and true path.
We have had our reporter David and Ann talk about the disappearing monarch butterflies, honeybees. I think it's an insecticide issue, but what do you think?
Well, yeah, you know, with the monarchs, I think there's two issues. I think there's sort of two things going on in each cases. With the monarchs, we don't have anywhere near as much of the milkweed, which is their primary food on their migration paths, because we've so overused the herbicides that have taken it out. And so we've we've kind of taken away a great part of their habitat over the last 15, 20 years with the overuse of glyphosate in our agricultural heartland. And with honeybees, there's some people that argue that it's viruses that are doing them, they're harming them. But there's also this new class of pesticides, the neonicotinoids, which are incredibly toxic to insects and bees in particular, that are probably wreaking havoc with those populations.
Back to you for a second, Ann, about your cancer and the microbe. We have always felt that cancers survive in acidic conditions. Is that the case?
I have heard that, George. I do not know a whole lot about that. I know that it is thought that cancer, certain kinds of cancer thrive in conditions of low-level chronic inflammation, and that certain cancers will also thrive in environments that are rich in carbohydrates and sugar. And that sort of makes sense because cancer cells grow very, very quickly, you know, faster than a normal cell. And in order to fuel that kind of growth, you need an energy source, which is, you know, sugar and carbohydrates. I'm not sure where the acidic environment comes into that.
But sugars are important, aren't they?
Too much of them, and it's thought that it plays a role in fueling the growth of certain kinds of cancer, yeah.
Okay, next up, Karen in Doyle, California. Hi, Karen, go ahead.
Hi, George. Listen, I have to disagree with the dog's microbes being real bad. A couple of months ago, they found that dogs have good probiotics in their saliva. And a year ago in the summer, I scratched my foot bad at the lake, scratched it, it had dirt and real tiny gravel pebbles in it. I put my foot in the water, and for some reason it burned, maybe because the drought was so down in the lake. When I got home that night, I said, "Madonna, come here. I got a hurt." So she took it, and she licked the dried blood off, and she licked some more, and I can see she's taking her teeth like you do if a dog has a flea, and she's doing it real lightly, real lightly. I'm like, ooh, ow, ooh, it's okay, though. Go ahead, you know? And she licked it until it bled a tiny bit like it was new. And she licked it some more, and I says, "I think you got all of the dirt out, honey." And she was all done. I just left it alone. The next day it scabbed over. I watched it. It cleared up. I mean, I never even washed it. I let the dog handle it, and it cleared up. There was no infection.
Well, we've also heard some amazing stories of dogs being able to sniff cancer from cancer patients or animals knowing when someone was going to die. There was a cat that would, go and visit every person who was about to die the next day. It was truly remarkable. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast with more of your questions for our special guests this hour, David Montgomery and Ann Biclay, The Hidden Half of Nature. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Hey, folks, a couple little notes here for you. We are auctioning off Dinner with Me at Morton's in Burbank, California. The bidding is going right now until May 1st to support the American Red Cross's initiative to Get Prepared California. You simply log on to KFIAM640.com, KFIAM640.com. In the search window, put Red Cross and then look for the auction. Proceeds go to disaster preparedness and relief in California, and that's always a great time. And also in St. Louis, circle June 18th. For my live stage show, including UFO expert Stanton Friedman, rock historian R. Gary Patterson, 97.1 Zone Mark Farley and Mark Close. We're going to have a great time, some live music with the Jim Manley Band, too. Tickets on sale right now. You can get them at 971talk.com through our affiliate, 971talk.com. Welcome back to Coast with our two special guests, David Montgomery and his wife, Ann Bickley. Ann, let me ask you, how are you doing with the cancer battle?
Well, I'm happy to say I am doing great with it.
Good.
Anytime you've had cancer and you're headed toward the five-year mark, that's a really good place to be.
That sure is. It sure is. Did you do anything naturally, or was it all mainstream medicine? What'd you do?
I did sort of a combo of things. Treatment for my cancer was surgery, a major surgery, and I also was seeing a naturopathic doctor, and she really helped me out with diet and nutrition, and because I had cancer once, I told her I don't want to ever have it again, so let's talk about how I can do that, and how can I support my immune system.
That's critical, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, earlier you were talking about how inflammation can be good. Now, inflammation in the arteries is not good.
That's right. Right. Yeah, inflammation is sort of like the microbial world. There's this duality about it, and that is that it's absolutely necessary that we have the appropriate type and level of inflammation when we're fighting some kind of a pathogen, when we are fighting cancer, because the inflammatory process is how that pathogen gets killed, and it's how our own immune cells will eat up a cancer cell. But when you're just walking around healthy, normal, day to day, you don't want inflammation happening, because it can be quite damaging to cells and tissues to have it go on and on and on. And your mention of inflammation in the arteries, that's what that is about. That's a state of inflammation that goes on years, maybe decades, and it is not good, and it is not good for arteries, and it's also not good, you know, if you've got inflammation in your liver, and your kidney, pancreas, and so on. That can just be simply quite damaging.
Can you see microbes with a little home microscope?
Sure, you can. Yeah, yeah. All you'd need to do, you know, in the book we talk about, there was this Dutch guy back in the 1600s, Anthony von Leeuwenhoek, and he was the one who was credited actually with discovering microbes. And he was an interesting person and also very curious himself. I think he started out he spit on a slide, or on some kind of a surface, and he was able to examine it under his homemade microscope. And he saw all these things squirming around and moving, and he couldn't believe his eyes. And he called them animalcules. Of course, we don't use that term anymore. You know, we say, oh, that's a bacteria or a whatever. But, oh, yeah, you could do that yourself today with, you know, just about anything, a drop of rainwater, maybe even with some tap water, or if you live somewhere where you're drinking well water, that might be interesting.
I've even seen some clever adapters to put on smartphones where you can use those as a little microscope and then take pictures of the microbes.
I like that. That's interesting. I love science. Let's go to James in South Carolina. James, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I had a question about, I think they're called prions. Is that a lesser form of virus, or how do they, do you know anything about that? Any information about what they are? I know it's mad cow disease is one of them.
David?
Well, I'm going to let Ann, the biologist.
Ann, okay. That's fair enough.
Yeah. Well, prions are something that was, I think, first discovered at least a couple of decades ago, and they're sort of in that category like viruses. They're this thing that, not quite alive, but it has some pretty interesting lifelike properties. And prions, I do know, as the caller said, they are implicated in mad cow disease, and they seem to have this ability to infect our tissues, or those, you know, or that of other mammals. Beyond that, I don't know much more about prions, except that for whatever reason, they are found in nervous system tissue, the brain and spinal cord and so forth.
How could something, Anne, be so minute and yet topple a human being?
You know, George, that is amazing. Here we have the tiniest creatures on Earth and these tiny things that are not really alive doing exactly what you said. And in part, if there was just, you know, one prion or one virus particle or one bacterium, we'd easily have the upper hand on them. But the thing is that these come in hordes. So it becomes, you know, a bit of a numbers game, you know, especially with a single pathogen, you know, that gets in you, or say it's, you know, a couple hundred or something like that. Once in our bodies, once they start either replicating or reproducing, then it turns into a numbers game with our immune cells. And as soon as these tiny creatures get the upper hand on our immune cells, it can be it can either be all over for us, or, you know, we're heading into some state of sickness or disease.
Yeah, it could be fatal. I mean, I have heard of stories that people go into the hospital and they get, the sepsis or something?
Right.
And they don't come back.
Yeah, no, we have one of the chapters of our book opens with the story of our dog actually got sepsis and almost died, had a close run-in with that. But we can kind of turn that numbers game around on microbes in a way by trying to cultivate the good ones. I mean, some of the very best preventative strategies to try and keep pathogens at bay is to make sure that our own digestive system, our own colon, or the root systems of plants that we're cultivating are full of the beneficial microbes, so the pathogens are beaten at the numbers game. There's actually a very small number of microbes that are human pathogens in the world relative to the total number of microbes that are in our microbiome. So, you know, there's something like 1,300 or so human pathogens, and there's, you know, millions of species of bacteria that are not pathogens. So if we can outnumber the bad ones with the ones that are either indifferent to us or that are actually beneficial to us, we can turn that numbers game strategy right back around on them.
Let's go to Lynn in Orange, California. Hey, Lynn, go ahead.
Hi. Actually, remarkably important topic in general in reference to our actual Earth and our body. In understanding and getting people to understand the importance of microbes in how they influence our whole life structure and getting them familiar with the terminologies and the concepts of it, it actually will help with a lot of things that we've heard you talk about on your show about, you know, with Roundup and understanding the importance of getting Roundup gone because it destroys all the good and, you know, the bad aspects of the microbes the structures around it, the soil, all of these things. And pharmaceuticals wouldn't be able to take advantage of us in not knowing our bodies well enough to know what is actually going to destroy the good macrobiotics in our digestive tract. So, and it's just remarkable how profoundly big, if it wants to go that big. There's a documentary called Green Gold, which pretty much documents the aspects of how in China they changed an area the size of New Zealand by actually changing the dynamics of the soil structure so that it would hold microbes, and so that something went from arid to desolate to almost, you know, like Nebraska, you know, in its lushness and its availability. And it changed the climate when they did that as well, and the water and the drought aspect. So little, creating enormous impact once we truly understand the dynamics of it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The implications of this stuff are huge. And it's one of the reasons we wrote the book, is to try and communicate the basic science and the implications to the general public. And in terms of the effects on agriculture and on Roundup and its overuse, I spent from last April to September traveling to farms around the world looking at practices where people are using those practices that can cultivate the beneficial microbes, things like not tilling, adding cover crops, using diverse crop rotations, things that would promote the microbial life and the transformations in terms of taking very degraded land back to very productive land are absolutely incredible. And the kind of these farmers that I was visiting were able to so greatly reduce their agrochemical inputs, both their fertilizer, their herbicides, their pesticides, reduced from 50 to 90%, depending on sort of which person I was visiting, and still maintain their crop yields, if not increase them. There's real lessons for how to really move forward to a better, more productive and long-lasting agriculture that actually produces more nutrient-dense food, which would be healthier for us.
Okay, and the $64,000 question, how did the first microbe start?
Oh, wow. Here I'm speechless, George. I'm not sure I've even come across any good sort of
explanation for
yeah,
it.
The very first one. Now that is interesting. That is the real mystery of the world.
Yeah, it really is.
Because
then one became two, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. But a microbe could do that. Because
just amazing.
Where there's one microbe, they just have simple cell division.
But how did we get the first one?
Yeah, I know.
Yep.
Yeah.
The big question.
That's somewhere out of the, you know, ye old primordial soup.
Yep.
Some organic.
Even if
molecule.
It came from a comet or fell off an asteroid or a piece of space right. rock, where did the first one come from? That's the question.
Yeah.
Let's go to William in Costa Rica. William, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, thank you so much. It's a pleasure, George, to be part of this.
Thank you.
Really good program you got. So we used to hear that on a daily basis or a nightly basis. Okay, you bring a really good question right here, you know. Probably the first microbe was brought from the Anunnakis, you know.
Mm-hmm, maybe.
But, you know, when you ask for the chlorine, you know, why the chlorine can kill a bacteria, you go to a basic chemistry. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, or we can talk about biology, you know, osmosis. The water goes from then a little concentrated to the more concentrated, trying to balance, you know, the cell. In this case, is a bacteria, and the bacteria works like a cell, you know. That's why they get dehydrated. That's why that kills them. If you know the salt, you know, sodium chlorine, is composed by sodium and chlorine, right? That's how the people in ancient times, they were able to store meat, you know? They put some salt on that.
It's like beef jerky.
Exactly.
Yes, correct. There you go. You have that. I just wanted to let these guys know about it.
Thank you, William. Thanks for listening
Thank
to us,
for
too.
Us.
We're worldwide, and that's obvious there.
Oh, yeah.
Next up, let's go to Robin, truck driving in Phoenix, Arizona. Robin, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Big fan. So is my grandpa.
Ah, thank you both.
My question is, in biblical times, we live to hundreds of years by the accounts of the Bible. And I've been thinking for the last couple of years. I think a lot, 11 hours a day, every day, because I'm a truck driver. And there's got to be another side to cancer, because cancer replicates automatically, continuously. It doesn't go through the process of apoptosis like most people do, you know, unless you're Henrietta Lacks. And I was thinking that maybe sometime in history there was some sort of pathogen or an amoeba that turned off that property that we have to be able to live that long. And I wanted to know what your guest might have thought about that.
The question is, could there have been some kind of a pathogen that is turning off the cancer process?
No. Maybe cancer, because we all have the cancer cells in our body automatically. Maybe the cancer had a function in the beginning.
Oh, okay, yeah, right. There's it could be something like that, because with a cancer cell, as with any cell, you want to be able to have cells grow, because that's how we replace tissue. And so you want a certain amount of growth. And it may well be, you know, in some cases, maybe you wanted really rapid growth and really rapid replacement of some kind of tissue. And it could be that perhaps that just got out of hand and the body was not able to shut that off. And then that's, of course, when we get the case of cancer. That's quite an interesting question.
Yeah, it is. Okay, yeah. Let's take Indianapolis. David, go.
Hello?
David?
Yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, there's another David. The one I want is not on the line. That was you, David, saying hello,
yeah,
right?
No. I was like, oh, is that the caller? Me?
David, where are you? Well, we've only got a minute left. Let's wrap up. Where do people find you? Websites? Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Our website is dig2grow, and that's D-I-G, the number 2, grow.com. And then we're on Twitter as well. Our handle is @dig2grow. And people can find out more. We've got some great information on the website. We've got some recipes there and some additional interviews and book reviews. And Twitter is you know, the account is such that anybody can look at it. You don't need to have your own Twitter account.
Okay, great. Thanks to both of you. I appreciate you being on the program.
Yeah, it's been a blast, George. Thank you.
Great job. I mean, who would know? You talked for a couple hours about microbes. But we did, those little critters, fascinating. Well, there's more to come on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to talk about the Titanic. We're going to talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki through the eyes of someone who's an explorer. It's an amazing series of stories that we're going to be talking with you about here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well. And don't touch your dial. We'll be right back with more.